This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio broadcast and online Main Street all across North Dakota. Today we'll start our show talking about a survey of our state that was conducted by the Institute of Policy and Business Analytics at the University of North Dakota in its Nistler College of Business and Public Administration. And we're joined this morning to talk about the survey by the fellow who had the lead on the survey and is the executive director of that organization, Jason Jensen. He's a professor in the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UND. Jason, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Very happy to talk about it.
And David Flynn has been on our show as well. He's the research director, and he's a professor of Department of Economics and Finance and an economist. We'll assess, I guess, the results of this survey that took place statewide. Is that correct, Jason? When was it conducted, and how was it conducted?
It was conducted beginning in late September. And it was concluded in late November. So it unfolded over quite a long period of time as the pandemic sort of was ebbing and flowing. And it was a random survey of 1,600 North Dakota adult residents and basically asking them questions related to not only the health impacts and opinions about regulations around COVID, but also economics, jobs, that sort of thing.
And it was conducted during the surge, the peak of the pandemic in the state so far, at any rate. David, what does an economist look for from a survey like this?
Well, I think one of the novel aspects of this survey is that it's providing us consumer feedback about their attitudes towards economic life. And so what we can gather from this is how behaviors are likely to change based on that kind of feedback. And it's better than just, are you worried or not worried? It's, given this little element of daily life, how are you going to change your behavior? And so it's a really important tool in that regard.
Professor Jensen, you mentioned eight regions in the state. Did the responses to the survey questions differ significantly in different regions?
For some of the questions, yes. The state is split up into eight regions. We didn't do that. Department of Commerce does that, and we borrowed their distinction. And for some of the questions, we noted differences based on region. And traditionally, North Dakota has a pretty significant east-west divide. So we did notice that as well on some of the questions, but that wasn't the case with all the questions. Some of them were pretty uniform across the state.
Well, we often look at that east-west divide as being Grand Forks and Fargo and the rest of the state. How did the survey define it?
Well, we really didn't do an east-west divide. We went with the eight regions. We also asked people what county they were from and their zip code so we can do a deeper dive for certain questions. But the problem is, as you start splitting up the survey into smaller and smaller pieces, it's harder and harder to do any sort of statistical analysis. A lot of the results we comment on are based on the entire state because those are statistically more reliable results.
Were there any significant findings for you, David?
Well, I think looking at the change in shopping behavior, it's made national news, it's made local news, and certainly the national stories have filtered down to the local level as well. People have changed shopping behavior as a result of this. And obviously, we see varying degrees. We see some very populous areas like a New York City really looking at drastic changes in behaviors because of that high population density and the ease of spread for a disease vector like COVID. But for me, I think the interesting thing is that the local information says that over 50% of people in some situations are changing their behaviors, either doing more online shopping or doing curbside pickup. I think you can tell I haven't really done that one yet. But you can see also in the other data that comes out there, the concerns about local retail sales, the concerns about going to restaurants, those concerns are there when you see people saying they're doing more online purchases and those kinds of things. We're seeing more of that minimizing contact.
Jason, the survey touched more than 1,600 residents of the state, 200 respondents in each of these eight districts, as you say, determined by the Commerce Department. When you were conducting the survey, were you gathering information about the age of the respondents, perhaps the political affiliation, the economic status, those kinds of things? What do we know about the people who responded?
Yeah, we asked some demographic questions, and phone surveys are much harder to give than they used to be for a variety of different reasons.
Yes.
And so what we're forced to do is stratify and to weight based on what we know about the state demographics. For instance, if we know that so many people fall into each age category and our survey doesn't pick up on those, we're able to statistically weight those afterwards. So what we end up with is a really fair cross-section of the state and in all demographic categories. To your question about politics, the purpose of the survey wasn't anything to do with politics, so we didn't directly ask about political affiliation or views about any particular government official specifically.
The survey was conducted, of course, during the pandemic, and I'm just wondering if other surveys elsewhere by academic institutions around the United States were being conducted too that you might be able to compare to.
We did do some of that, and one of the interesting results of the survey was that there's a pretty sizable percentage of people who are opposed to the vaccine, and what we tried to do was to see if this changed over time. And one of the, you know, we didn't plan it this way, but during the course of the survey, when we were giving it, Pfizer came out with their original announcement about their successful trials. And so this gave us an opportunity to sort of see if people's opinions changed about the vaccine based on that news. And we did see a small uptick in terms of people who noted that they were willing to get vaccinated. But that percentage of people in North Dakota, which is about 30%, who seem to be unwilling. I was just looking at the U.S. Census Bureau Household Pulse Survey, and for North Dakota, that's still at about 30% as of mid-March. So that seems to be a pretty consistent result.
David, you mentioned how consumers have changed or altered their behaviors, as indicated in the survey, and probably just our own anecdotal experiences. How about businesses that used to have a lot of employees where they had the headquarters, like Prairie Public? We often work from home. I have a basement studio. Many businesses have done that. Is this going to be a lasting change in that part of the operation?
I think that's something that all businesses are actually grappling with right now. And in part, it's going to be a response to how are our customers differing in their interactions with us. So exactly what do I need in terms of a fixed location? In part, it's a matter of what can I ship out and have done in home offices, like you mentioned. And so I think there'll be a significant shake up in that regard going forward. I do think that the idea that it will be some kind of a commercial real estate apocalypse is probably an overplayed concern. I don't think that the storefront goes away, and I don't think the central business building will go away. But We could see downsizing. We could see changes in scale as a result, certainly.
David Flynn is a professor in the Department of Economics and Finance at UND, and Jason Jensen is a professor of the Department of Political Science and Public Administration and an executive director in the Institute of Policy and Business Analytics. We're talking about a statewide survey conducted last fall into attitudes around business and consumer attitudes around the pandemic. Jason, the Grand Forks Herald had an interesting analysis of your results, and they reported, and I'm quoting here, the survey polled residents about where they turned to get trustworthy information about the virus. 42% said they went to traditional news sources, 22% said the Centers for Disease Control, and 21% said they used the North Dakota Department of Health website. For me, the element that stood out, jumped out at that page, was what were the traditional news sources?
That's a great question, and of course you picked up on it. We didn't dig into that. Basically, the question was an open-ended question. We certainly were interested in figuring out if, you know, everybody has opinions, and where do these opinions come from, particularly about the pandemic, where are people getting their information, and in terms of public policy, is it open to being impacted? And so it was an open-ended question where we asked people, where do you get your information? And they gave us more than one answer usually. And then afterwards we went through and we categorized it. So your question is a great question, because traditional media sources, that seems like a large percentage, 42%, but we're not sure exactly what people consider to be traditional news sources. The other two highest categories were Center for Disease Control, that's pretty straightforward, and North Dakota Department of Health website is pretty straightforward. But this is an area, I think, for follow-up survey perhaps, is to figure out, you know, what news sources or what media sources are people getting information from, and how does this impact their answers?
Well, 20 years ago, I think we could have all pretty well answered the question, but yeah. These days, a traditional news source might be my favorite echo chamber.
Yep.
David, what was your overall assessment from the results of the survey, and also the results of other data that you're looking at all the time? What is the state's economic circumstance? How did it weather the worst part of the pandemic so far, and what's its outlook?
Well, I think it weathered, to get to the end part here, I think it weathered it reasonably well, certainly compared to how some other states were doing and are doing. I think the outlook remains fairly good, but again, just like we hear flare-ups in other places and concerns about variants, I think there's still cause to be concerned. I think the biggest information coming out of this survey is not for government officials on policy fronts or even necessarily academics, although I find it very interesting. I think businesses need to have a big takeaway from this survey. And the big takeaway is that consumers are displaying dynamic responses and pivoting how they're shopping and how they're interacting with wherever they're getting their goods and services from. And so this brings to mind a need for businesses to really not rest, not sit back and say, okay, we made it through and we can go back to business as usual, but to somewhat carefully assess the long run outlook. Everybody's looking for that real easy, I can rest and take a breath moment. But I think businesses, if they want to thrive going forward, need to understand that your customer base is looking like it's ready to pivot. And that came through in a couple of the two scenarios that were asked as well. The change in behavior that was there was very clear.
Jason, David looks at this from the perspective of an economist. How about the political science or the public administration perspective? What were the most significant findings for you from this survey?
Well, as somebody who studies public policy, teaches public policy, I was interested primarily in the response of government officials, and how those steps intersected with public opinion. It was a really tough situation for government officials, you know, being in the middle of a pandemic where, you know, any decision seems to be a lose-lose decision, and trying to find this sweet spot between not doing enough and doing too much in terms of restrictions, and you're never going to please everybody. So, you know, I think the governor, and these are the results of the survey speaking, I think that the governor managed to navigate that sweet spot pretty well. And again, we're in a situation now where any decision is attacked, and it's really difficult. But, you know, considering how everything could have gone, and, you know, here I'm talking about restrictions on businesses, you know, those sorts of things. And by the way, one of the results of the survey that was really telling was that overall people in North Dakota were pretty supportive of interventions that businesses made and that government made, but they weren't supportive of shutdowns.
Well, did you ask about masks? Because that seems to be a lightning rod issue in our state and elsewhere, for that matter. The legislature is considering a law against a statewide mask mandate. Was that assessed by the survey?
It was, and our respondents were pretty supportive of wearing masks, and that was a pretty high percentage of people had changed their behavior and were wearing masks. And given that, you know, the juxtaposition is a mask mandate, which is sort of different from individuals choosing to wear masks. And I think that's where the legislature struggles. But, you know, given the finding of the survey, the legislature's decision to ban mandates to me doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because most people are supportive of masks.
David, businesses, of course, have to be very sensitive about how their customers feel about what they're doing. Did the survey indicate that the business practices that might have been dealing with a mandate from the state or from their own sense of vulnerability, were there lessons learned about that?
I think there were. You look at the survey results, and as Jason alluded to, the respondents were very supportive, 60% or more, generally speaking, on steps that businesses took in terms of things like limiting the number of patrons in the store at a given time, mask mandates, and those kinds of things. So the steps that businesses took, generally speaking, we saw very strong support out of the survey for that. And I think that's something that is a really important takeaway. Again, businesses looking to the future, if the business is taking steps, I think that the public, whether they like it or not, I think to a large extent accepts it. You know, the nightly news story of somebody throwing a fit at a store because they're being told to wear a mask or leave, notwithstanding. I mean, those seem to be more of an exception, not the rule, but they get a lot of the attention. I think the general information here is businesses taking these steps to protect customers, and an element we haven't touched on, protect their employees, because yes, of course the liabilities there are still unclear in many scenarios and situations, but protecting employees and protecting the general public so that they can give at least some assessment that their shopping space is as safe as it can be, that's well received by the respondents in this survey. Absolutely.
Professor Jensen, as the executive director of the Institute of Policy and Business Analytics, it's a relatively new institute, 2019, I think it was formed. How do you decide what to survey?
Well, we're in the Nistler College of Business and Public Administration, and so we're one of the rare business schools in the country that has public affairs, public administration, and public policy under the same roof as business. And so what we're really interested in is sort of the connection between public and private. And in terms of what we decide to survey or study, we don't only do surveys, we do other sorts of research. We have the grand challenges of the university that we're interested in. All of those have a very direct connection to public policy. And honestly, if somebody comes to us and wants a survey done, we would do it on a contractual basis as well.
I want to ask this question of you, David, because I'm curious about this as an economist. We've had this remarkable experiment in financial activity by the government. We've had these three rounds of help that have been sent from the federal government, created by Congress and the administrations. The most recent one, $1.9 trillion nationwide and well over $1 billion earmarked for North Dakota. What does this gush of federal money do for the state?
Well, it'll be interesting to see. Obviously, there are, you know, it's not a blank check. There are, you know, some restrictions, limitations, and recommendations put on these dollars. I think it'll be interesting with North Dakota in particular, because while we saw a drop off in employment immediately after closures and in the initial COVID phases, it recovered significantly, but not fully across the state. And I think it will be important to see how we use that in ways that can enhance and further infrastructure, ways that can enhance and further broader economic activity. And so I think that really there will be these opportunities there. But to get back to something we were talking about earlier, I think for all business sectors, it's important to figure out how a, for lack of a better word, a COVID with vaccine economy looks. In terms of, are people going to be back in offices? Are more offices going to do remote? What's defined as the sort of essential on-site staffing for a particular workplace? These are questions that not only North Dakota, but everybody's grappling with. But I think North Dakota, with its mix of ag, energy, and a lot of other activities that support it, is going to be in a very interesting place to try and come up with answers for that.
Professor Jensen, you mentioned that the Institute, tries to do work surveys that support the business objectives of the state. Does the state communicate with you about stuff they'd like investigated, looked at, surveyed?
Well, so we're still in startup mode, and the Institute was an outgrowth of several different centers that were in the college. One of them dealt a lot with public affairs, one dealt with economics, and one dealt with primarily survey research. And so part of our startup challenge has been to reach out to folks in the state, agencies, government officials, and also regionally and locally. And we've been fairly successful at that. Certainly we've had a lot of interactions with the Department of Commerce, Department of Health, but we look for that to continue and expand and evolve over time, because we really do want to serve the state.
Jason Jensen is the Executive Director of the Institute of Policy and Business Analytics in UND's Nistler College of Business and Public Administration. Thank you for being with us, Jason.
Thank you.
And David Flynn is a professor in the Department of Economics and Finance. David, a pleasure to have you with us as well.
Thank you very much.
Coming up on Main Street, a conversation about northern border security with Burke County Sheriff Sean Breen. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The state Senate has passed the bonding bill at the level the House set. That means it's on its way to Governor Burgum. The House version was $680 million. The Senate adopted amendments to boost it to $1.1 billion. But Fargo Republican Senator Ron Sorvug said things are changing and evolving.
Part of it is the federal dollars that are coming in, and recognizing that at times they're able to replace dollars that we were planning on. And some of these are going other. So a lot of the items that were added on are still part of the discussions in other areas and budgets and the movement of federal funds.
Still in the bonding bill, money for the FM diversion, money for the Mouse River flood control, and money for a new agriculture building on the NDSU campus. The vote on House Bill 1431 was unanimous. When the North Dakota House passed the Higher Education Challenge Grant Bill, it took out the two private universities in North Dakota. The Senate's version of the measure made the University of Mary and Jamestown University eligible. The challenge grants would be awarded on a match basis. Meaning for every $2 the college foundations would raise, the state would add $1. Osnabrück Representative David Munson chairs the Education and Environment section of House Appropriations.
Well, we've never had it in before for the privates, and I guess we just thought that we should go back to the way we had originally set it up.
The House version also adds the UND Medical School to the list of eligible colleges. Grand Forks Republican Representative Mark Sanford.
The med school was originally in the challenge grant process. And the decision was made to take them out a couple of sessions ago when there was resources were very, very slim. And so it was one of those, well, we got to get something to every campus at that time, and it never did get restored last time. So I think it's appropriate.
The language for the challenge grant appropriation is in two bills, Senate Bill 2030 and Senate Bill 2003. And it's been more than 7 months since construction started on Amazon's massive fulfillment center north of Hector International Airport in Fargo. And a union leader says progress is moving ahead at a rapid pace. The earliest completion date was set for August. Jason Elhert, president of the North Dakota Building Trades Unions, says structural steel, precast walls, and roofing are nearing completion, and work is underway on pouring 1,300 yards of concrete daily for the interior floor. Elhert says there are about 150 union construction workers on site now. That does not include foremen and superintendents.
As a structural phase gets completed, that's when the more of the trades will come in. So you're talking more carpenters, drywall finishers, painters, electricians on more of that finish packages, maybe if there's any polishing of floors or anything like that. So it is still a giant warehouse. So, what you traditionally have with like office spaces and carpeting and everything else, that won't be a huge demand.
The $100 million to $120 million distribution center being built on 110 acres of former farmland is considered the largest building built in North Dakota. The 19 football fields would fit inside. The company is planning to hire 500 full-time employees. Amazon has not yet announced when hiring will begin. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
I'm Dave Thompson. On this week's Legislative Review, we'll talk with Bismarck Republican Representative Mike Nafee about investing legacy fund income into the state of North Dakota, also the bonding bill, and how things stand as the legislature goes to its home stretch. Legislative Review is 6:30 p.m. Friday on Prairie Public's radio service, as well as on our digital platforms.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Sean Breen. He is the Burke County Sheriff, and he joins us by the side of the road. He's just been up to visit his Border Patrol colleagues at Portal, North Dakota. Sheriff Breen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Burke County is sparsely populated. How is your department organized? What are your principal enforcement activities?
So I have a staff of six officers. Five patrol deputies, one office deputy, and myself. We have an area of about 1,200 square miles, and we're very limited, as far as between trying to answer our calls and try also to protect our borders as well.
Well, let's talk about that. Yesterday, Senator John Hovind, who's a member of the Senate Homeland Security Appropriations Committee, visited your part of the state to talk about northern border issues. What did he want to know?
So basically, he wanted to know his concerns as far as, what's going on at the northern border. What happened there was I sent Senator Hovind a letter a few weeks back about our concerns up here at the northern border, specifically, our Burke County, Divide County, and Renville County, or just my neighboring counties, and all across the northern border, because we've been having a lot of illegal entries from Canada, you know, caravans of people coming through illegally, and, you know, even people coming in and then going right back into Canada, probably testing our security. And the lack of Border Patrol officers that we have on the northern border, they are very shorthanded, and we need more Border Patrol officers up here.
Well, we've certainly seen all of the attention given to our southern border with Mexico, and I assume that some Border Patrol officers may have been reassigned, whatever. But what is your responsibility for the northern border? You're not Border Patrol.
Well, we're not Border Patrol, but, you know, anybody that does obviously come into our county illegally, you know, that's also our responsibility, you know, to try and catch and apprehend these people. You know, when they do cross the border, if we are able to apprehend them, we hold them for Border Patrol. I mean, sometimes it could take a half hour, it could take up to an hour, you know, for Border Patrol to, you know, come to us. It just depends upon where they're at. So from there, Border Patrol will come and take the people who cross the border, and then they take them back to their office and do the paperwork that they have to do.
And what might Senator Hovind be able to do for you to help out?
Well, if people are familiar with our northern border, it's very easily accessed. I mean, you can take a prairie trail right across our border.
Oh, yes.
Or, you know, just by driving across. So, you know, what we've kind of asked him if, you know, if any way he could find ways to put up barriers, you know, like the big cement barriers that you see, you know, on the interstate. You know, put those across certain crossings. Certain crossings are open where, you know, on each side, you know, you can even drive around the barrier. So, you know, we've also asked that maybe put up some fencing, you know, so far past the barriers, you know, just basically fencing like a regular farm ranch fence, so with barbed wire. Something to deter the people, you know, that shows that, you know, can't come around it, you know, go back. Stuff like that. And then also, of course, the big concern of the shortage of Border Patrol. I'm hoping that, you know, we can get through, you know, to Washington, and they can give us more funding to help with this.
Well, you got my attention when you talked about caravans of people coming across the border. We usually associate that with the southern border concerns. Are these refugees? Are these drug runners? What are they?
I guess I shouldn't say like caravans of people. It's usually a couple of vehicles at a time. And a lot of the people that's coming across are Romanians, whether they are Canadian citizens. More likely they are Canadian citizens, but they're Romanians coming into the U.S. And I believe, you know, they're not coming to just stay in North Dakota. They want to go to the southern states. So that's the problem we've been having up here, you know, in for sure Burke County and Divide County are the vehicles coming across that are Romanians. And they're usually, you know, loaded with, you know, of course, adults and children.
What about drug coming across the border? I mean, Canada is now a recreational marijuana country.
You know, we haven't yet obviously caught, you know, anybody coming across with loads of, you know, drugs or anything like that. But, you know, a lot of the illegal entries that we do have, you know, some of those we don't catch. So obviously some of those could be, you know, the drug mules bringing in loads. It's hard to say, but so far we haven't caught anything like that crossing our border. Do I think it's happening? Absolutely. It's just we can't catch every single person that comes across the border because we're just lacking the that extra security.
Well, you mentioned that the Border Patrol needs more Border Patrollers, and clearly that makes more work for you. So is there some way the federal government compensates Burke County for the additional work?
So there is a grant. It's called Operation Stone Garden. It's a grant that gives counties along the northern border overtime money to help patrol the border. So we do get that grant money to help patrol the border so many hours a day. So that does help Border Patrol out quite a bit, knowing that we're actually out there for those extra few hours every day to, you know, to help out, you know, just patrolling those back roads.
Well, we often refer to the border with Canada as the longest, friendliest border in the world, you know, and I can recall either border, southern or northern border, where it was very easy to cross. It's much more difficult now. Of course, we've got a pandemic. Since last March, the border with the U.S. and Canada has been pretty much closed. So what about commerce? There is still some of that going on. And do people who just want to, you know, slip across the border to shop in Fargo or Grand Forks do that still?
You know, I think, you know, people are still trying to get across the border just to get across and do that kind of stuff, shopping and stuff like that. You know, I don't think every person crossing the border illegally is a criminal. You know, I think some people are trying to cross to, you know, give themselves a better life, you know, here in the United States, and give their children a better life. You know, it's really hard to say.
Well, what about access? I've got a good friend who grew up in the Crosby, North Dakota area and was born in a Canadian hospital, has dual citizenship. What if you have a difficult labor? You got to get to the hospital, and the closest one is in Canada.
Yeah, I honestly don't think that there would be a problem with that. If it's an emergency type of thing, I don't think that there would be a problem with that.
Do you lose deputies? Do law enforcement agencies in North Dakota lose deputies or cops or whatever to the Border Patrol? I mean, they might have a better pay scale.
You know, I think that does happen to some agencies. You know, some of them go to Customs and Border Protection just because of the, you know, a little bit better pay and the benefits, you know, seem to be a little bit better. Obviously, it's more of a workload, you know, working under the government, but for sure it's definitely a little bit, you know, actually quite a bit better pay.
But at this point, you're saying that your activities in sort of concert with border surveillance is up. I assume maybe because of what's happening at the southern border, maybe because of the pandemic, but you're busier doing that than you would have been doing normal law enforcement activities?
We've been fairly busy as far as, you know, our cameras going off. The sheriff's office does put cellular cameras up along the border. So whenever we get, you know, pictures of on our cell phones of vehicles in the area of the border, we tend to try and act on it. Whether we see the vehicle going northbound or southbound, you know, we pay attention both ways. So yeah, we do spend quite a bit of time along the border just watching that.
Well, you just referred to some technological advantages you might have in 2021. Are eventually, do you foresee drones surveilling the border, other technologies brought to bear to better surveil what's happening at the border?
You know, Customs and Border Protection, they do have drones, you know, in North Dakota. I guess I haven't seen them flying up here, but I know they do use them along the border once in a while. As far as us getting one over here, you know, it's really hard to say. Maybe someday down the line, you know, we can get small drones to patrol the border and stuff like that, but I don't see it happening anytime soon.
Well, you mentioned that the Operation Stone Garden provides some federal funding for local law enforcement when you're working overtime and all that. Well, what about burnout? Are you concerned about that? Are you working too much?
You know, it can get to be a long day, but it's actually not that bad. You know, we split our Stone Garden shifts up where it, you know, it's not, you know, tiring out the officers and stuff like that. So we're not, you know, putting a guy on 2 days in a row for Stone Garden, because that can get to be a, you know, couple long shifts. So we spread them out, you know, pretty evenly to where it's not tiring those guys out.
Well, thank you for bringing us up to date on a very interesting wrinkle in border security, our very own northern border. Sean Breen is the sheriff of Burke County. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Coming up next on Main Street Eats with Sue Balcom.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Tri-Valley Opportunity Council of Crookston, offering volunteer opportunities for seniors, helping both students or fellow seniors with a variety of needs and activities. Volunteers receive benefits and make a difference in their communities. Learn more at tvoc.org.
Government officials in South Africa banned booze to keep people from gathering during the pandemic.
We saw a dramatic drop in hospitalizations, but more specifically, we saw a dramatic drop in trauma-related hospitalizations.
That opened more beds for COVID-19 patients and new conversations about the country's complicated relationship with alcohol on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and Sue Belcom. It's time for Main Street Eats.
Sue Belcom joins us from her farm outside of Mandan, the Root Cellars Farm, to talk about food. And this time, Sue, you want to talk about, and I'm not sure, is it halva or is it halva?
That's, we pronounced it halva.
Okay.
And one of our listeners suggested that I know about it because they must have gone to some good German Russian holiday dinner and had some halva, which I found in the store probably a couple years ago. It's usually back in the meat department. So I'm like, whoa, we used to have that every Easter and every Christmas. Mm. And so I bought some to take to my dad, who's still in assisted living in Jamestown. And he's like, I hate that stuff.
It's Middle Eastern, though, isn't it?
Oh, gee, I know. So think about that. Like, it was at every holiday that I can remember as a kid. It comes in a white, which would be vanilla, and it comes in a dark, which would be chocolate, and then it comes mixed, like chocolate vanilla ice cream would. And the only thing I can figure out is that it, you know, it's a Middle Eastern, West Asian, you know, Horn of Africa, Chinese sort of thing, because it is made from sesame seeds.
Mm-hmm. I love it.
And of course, well, you have to like the texture of it too, don't you think?
Yeah, it is a little drying, but
and a little it's a confection, but it's not quite like eating a candy bar.
Right.
But they say that it has some background in the Balkans, which is the only thing I can figure out. The Russians probably ate halva. And then my German family would have been, right. And then they brought it with them over to this country. St. John's bread is another one of those like really strange things that we had that we never really knew anything about, but it was just kind of there all the time. So I did a little research into what it was, actually. It's kind of a sesame paste, to say the least. But the big thing is that you can make it at home. I found a recipe for it, and I'm like, holy cow, that's bizarre, because I don't know how many stores carry it anymore, whether it's seasonal or not. I have no idea. I couldn't find any articles that connected my family's heritage to this particular confection. So, Doug, have you ever tried it? Do you know what we're talking about?
I know what you're talking about. I don't know that I've ever tried it. I have seen it, and I'm intrigued by it because it does look like it's easy to make.
Right, and it's got nuts, pistachios, our favorite, and cardamom in it, which is one of my favorite.
I make
spices.
A coffee halva. That's really delicious.
Oh, am I getting some of that someday, like for my birthday or something?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
It sounds wonderful.
Yeah, it is really good. Molly Ye has that recipe.
Oh, is it hard to find the ingredients? Do you have trouble finding tahini paste or anything like that?
No, that's available at pretty much any grocery store, but I specifically go to the Asian market in town to get it.
Oh, there you go. And we actually have an Asian market now that is just like, it's so fascinating to go in there. And they've got seafood, and they've got all these kinds of wonderful noodles that you can make. And I never thought to go down there for tahini. I found some at the grocery store once, which I really like it. But yeah.
Well, and if you have a good blender, too, and sesame seeds and a little sesame oil, it's not that hard. I can't ever get it quite as smooth, though. And so for a recipe like halva, where you really do want it smooth...
Can't believe how simple this is. You know, it's pistachio kernels and cardamom, cinnamon, water, sugar, and a little bit of lime juice. And then it's kind of like, I think, all in how you cook it. You know that there's ways to caramelize sugar and water, and sometimes that can be a disaster because if you're not using a candy thermometer, it is a little more difficult to judge whether or not that's been cooked long enough. You know, like popcorn balls have one temperature and Divinity has another temperature. And tahini is about 250 degrees on a candy thermometer.
I'm thinking there must be a YouTube video for making halva or making tahini, because there's a YouTube video for just about everything.
When you're making this candy base to which you add the... pistachio kernels. First, you have to toast them because, as you know, toasting, there's nothing better than toasting sunflower seeds or walnuts or almonds in your oven. And they just have such a better flavor and a better texture. So you roast your pistachio seeds, or toast them, I guess. And you can do it in a skillet or you can do it in the oven. And I actually toast rice sometimes before I cook it because it just brings out that really nutty flavor. And then you season that, the nuts, and then you use the sugar and the water and the lime juice to kind of make this caramelized syrup that should be about the consistency of honey. And then you just add the nuts to that. And then, of course, you have to put it in a mold. And unlike... fruit cake. You don't pour bourbon or brandy over it. You've just got to eat it plain. I'm sorry, but let it mold until it's nice and firm. And then we sliced it. We just sliced it and ate it. And I think we ate it with our meals. We didn't really eat it like as a dessert, but I have to laugh because my dad was like, God, get that out of here. It was a huge disappointment to me because I was thinking I was doing him a favor, you know, but I wasn't. So I don't know. I'm going to wait for some of that coffee flavored halva from you, Ashley, because it sounds really good. What do you use to flavor it?
Coffee
flavor. Just regular coffee?
Yeah, it's just coffee grounds.
You actually put the grounds in there,
huh? I think so. Gosh, I better look
that
this
up. That is so bizarre.
From the Molly on the Range cookbook, which, you know, Molly Yeh, she has a farm outside of East Grand Forks, and she has a show on the Food Network. So I'm looking it up, and it says ground coffee. So
wow.
Thank you, Internet. Okay.
We have dissected halva for Main Street Eats, and who knew about the connection from, you know, the Middle East or the Balkans to central North Dakota. But there it is. Sue Belcom peeled that onion, and we have discovered halva. Thank you, Sue, for Main Street Eats. Always a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you. I'm sorry, but this is as good as it gets today.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 8th. The history of smallpox in North Dakota spans centuries. The terrible disease devastated the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara people in 1781. Years later, in 1804, along the Missouri River near the mouth of the Hart River, Meriwether Lewis and William Clark saw Earth Lodge villages abandoned due to the dual threats of smallpox and Yanktonai raids. In 1837, a steamboat stopping at Fort Clark near present-day Washburn, North Dakota, carried passengers infected with smallpox. The virus tore through the native people living near the trading post. 90% of the Mandans died, as well as half of the Hidatsas and Arikaras. Fort Clark's manager documented the epidemic in his journal, writing, "Where the disease will stop, I know not. He wrote that the mounting deaths also included suicides and noted that the native people blamed the whites for the epidemic. Smallpox all but destroyed the tribes. The virus continued into the days of Dakota Territory and North Dakota's early years. Cities established pest houses for quarantines. Grand Forks's first physician, Dr. George Haxton, died in a smallpox epidemic in 1878. Smallpox could strike anywhere, from threshing crews to barbershops, to the state capital. When smallpox scares occurred, local school and health officials often ordered vaccinations. On this date in 1954, newspaper readers learned of a 23-year-old man in New England, North Dakota, who would become the state's last smallpox patient. The case prompted health authorities to hold a vaccination clinic for anyone wishing to be immunized. The last known smallpox death on Earth has a connection to North Dakota. In 1978, a British medical photographer fell ill and died after being accidentally exposed to the virus in a university lab in Birmingham, England. Among her many close contacts was a 20-year-old British woman who had gone to Mapes, North Dakota, for a 2-week vacation on a farm. State and federal health officials made sure she isolated in an upstairs bedroom until it had been 21 days since her last contact with the smallpox case. The 7 people living in the farmhouse were immediately vaccinated. Health personnel visited the woman daily. She returned to England, happy and healthy, and no one got sick. The World Health Organization declared smallpox eradicated from the world in 1980 after a global vaccination program. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight.
Hello, and welcome to Hippocrates Cafe, where we place healthcare in context through story and song. There are times, like now, when the arts may be the most helpful way to make sense of what we are experiencing. In that sense, the arts really are a form of medicine.
Watch Hippocrates Cafe, Reflections on the Pandemic, tonight at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, on Prairie Public.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. Friday on our show, we'll talk with Jack Russell Weinstein about his upcoming Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. This month, his topic is Talking to Mothers About Motherhood, and will feature a discussion with Danielle LaSouza. Dave Thompson will review the week's big stories, and Madeline will review another new movie, One Night in Miami. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.